Prompted as always by Cromwell, he now opened negotiations with the German Duke of Cleves, whose sister Anne, as his ambassador Christopher Mont reported, was said to be incomparable, as well for the face as for the whole body, excelling the beauty of the Duchess of Milan as the golden sun excelleth the silver moon. Henry was interested, but it was only after he had sent Hans Holbein to Cleves and had studied the portrait with which Holbein returned that he was ready to propose. A local painter who was considered for the commission was Lucas Cranach, the elder, but he was ill at the time. It is interesting to speculate, if he had indeed produced a portrait, how Henry would have reacted. Was Holbein to blame for what followed? Surely not. There are two versions of his portrait, one in the Louvre, the other in the Victoria and Albert Museum. In both of them Anne looks perfectly presentable, though perhaps not much more than that. One of the envoys to Cleves, a certain Nicholas Wotton, described the portrait as a very lively, i.e. lifelike, image, warning the king at the same time that the lady spent most of the time with her needle, that she was scarcely cultivated and was quite unable to sing or play, for they take it here in Germany for a rebuke, and an occasion of lightness that great ladies should be learned or have any knowledge of music. Meanwhile, since it was the dead of winter, the young princess travelled from her home at Düsseldorf via Antwerp to Calais in order to give her the shortest possible sea journey, for the good, it was said, of her complexion. She arrived at Deal on the 27th of December and rode from there to Rochester, where she arrived on New Year's Day 1540. The king, understandably impatient to see his bride, rode down with some trepidation for a secret glimpse, and was horrified. "I am ashamed," he declared, "that men have so praised her as they have done, and I like her not." The New Year gifts he had brought her were withheld, and he was at his wit's end as she travelled to Greenwich. The marriage was delayed for 2 days while he tried in vain to find a way out. At last, finding none, he resolved to go through with it, but the union with the Flanders mayor was never consummated. The very sight of his new wife, he claimed, induced instant impotence. As he himself put it, he left her as good a maid as he found her. After a month of marriage, Anne praised the king to the Countess of Rutland. "When he comes to bed," she said, "he kisseth me, and he taketh me by the hand, and biddeth me, 'Good night, sweetheart,' and in the morning kisseth me, and biddeth, 'Farewell, darling.'" "There must be more than this," Lady Rutland remarked, "or it will be long ere we have a Duke of York." The marriage was annulled, in the circumstances without much difficulty, on the 10th of July. Anne made no trouble. She did all that was expected of her, and somewhat surprisingly, in spite of her brother's entreaties, decided to stay on in England. She then retired to enjoy Richmond Palace and Hever Castle, formerly the property of the Boleyns, both of which magnificent residences Henry had settled on her, together with an income of £500 a year. As time went on, the two became surprisingly good friends, and Anne was always referred to as the king's beloved sister. She was the last of his wives to die, and the only one to be buried in Westminster Abbey. When Francis returned from Aiguemont to Paris, it was to find to his satisfaction that the persecution of the Protestants, frequently accompanied by hideous tortures, was continuing as relentlessly as ever. By now several hundred had been burned at the stake, many thousands rendered homeless. On the 1st of June 1540, he issued what was to become known as the Edict of Fontainebleau, which declared that Protestantism was high treason against God and mankind, and so deserved the appropriate punishments of torture, loss of property, public humiliation, and death. And as if that were not enough, several other edicts of a similar kind were to be published in the reigns of his successors. Meanwhile, the Reign of Terror continued. Often, if Protestants formed the majority of the population, whole villages were destroyed. The worst of these atrocities occurred during the summer of 1545 in the little town of Merindol in the Vaucluse. The victims on this occasion were not Huguenots, but Waldensians, a Christian sect of ancient origin, still existing today, which, despite a number of doctrinal differences, had embraced the Protestant Reformation. Somehow they came under the scrutiny of the authorities in Paris, as a result of which, on the 18th of November 1541, the Parlement of Provence issued the so-called Arrêt de Merindol, which proved effectively to be the town's death warrant. There was a pause for 4 years, during which successive appeals were made on its behalf, all of them unsuccessful. Then, in 1545, there arrived an army of 2,000 men returning from the Italian wars. They showed no mercy, destroying not only the town itself, but some 24 neighbouring Waldesian villages. Thousands were killed, thousands more lost their homes, while hundreds of able-bodied men were sent off to be galley slaves. When it was over, both Francis and Pope Paul announced their enthusiastic approval, the Pope going so far as to decorate the man principally responsible, Jean Meunier d'Oppede, who happened to be president of the Parlement of Provence. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon of Saturday, 10th of June 1540, just a month before the annulment of Anne of Cleves's marriage, Thomas Cromwell was arrested by the captain of the guard as he sat, surrounded by his ministers, at the council table. Then and there the Duke of Norfolk and the Earl of Southampton tore off his Order of the Garter with the words, "A traitor must not wear it." "This, then, is my reward for faithful service," he murmured in reply. He was then led through a postern to a boat waiting in the river and rowed down to the Tower. Cromwell had long faced formidable enemies, ambitious rivals such as Stephen Gardiner, and aristocrats like Norfolk, whom he had elbowed aside, all of whom were determined to regain royal favour, but knew that they could never do so while this plebeian upstart remained in power. His fall was remarkably like that of Wolsey 10 years before, engineered by Norfolk, assisted by Gardiner, and hinging on a failed marriage. The failure of Henry's proposed union with Anne of Cleves, which Cromwell had been the first to suggest, and had enthusiastically supported, had given the conspirators precisely the opportunity they had been waiting for. Having sought an audience with the king, they accused his chief minister not only of having been responsible for the debacle, but also of other, far more serious charges, including treason and heresy. He had, they continued, supported the Anabaptists, a Christian sect which believed in delaying baptism until the candidate confessed his or her faith. It was heavily persecuted during the 16th century. Protected Protestants accused of heresy, and even plotted to marry Princess Mary himself. The Bill of Attainder has been described as a tissue of half-truths and lies, and it may have been for that reason that Cromwell was never brought to trial. He was simply beheaded on Tower Hill, after which his head was set on a spike on London Bridge. The contemporary chronicler, Edward Hall, records that he spoke briefly on the scaffold, protesting that, though many had slandered him, he was dying in the traditional faith. After that he patiently suffered the stroke of the axe by a ragged and butcherly miser, which very ungodly performed the office. Why Henry had allowed himself to be persuaded to execute his greatest and most faithful counsellor is hard to understand. He was to regret his action bitterly before the year was out. But by then the damage was done, and, in the words of his principal biographer, he had lost for ever a genius, perhaps the most accomplished servant any English monarch has enjoyed, a royal minister who cut a deeper mark on the history of England than have many of her monarchs. J.J. Scarisbrick, Henry VIII. When he first fell in love with Anne Boleyn's cousin, Catherine Howard, Henry would describe her as a rose without a thorn, but he did not do so for long. Catherine had been introduced to the court at the end of 1539, a short, rather plump girl, 19 years old at the most, by her uncle, the Duke of Norfolk. Her family praised her for her pure and honest condition, but this was not strictly true. She already had at least 2 affairs to look back on, one with her music teacher, Henry Mannix, the other with the dashing young courtier, Francis Derham. Even after her marriage to Henry, which took place on the day Thomas Cromwell was beheaded, she remained incurably flirtatious. Henry, on the other hand, as everyone around him knew, was by now a deeply unsatisfactory lover. For him, sex had long been a means of propagation and little else. Once the job was done, he had no further interest in the matter. It was thus perhaps not entirely surprising that by the late summer of 1541, Catherine had got herself seriously involved with one of the gentlemen at the Privy Chamber, Thomas Culpeper, an association which, when it was discovered by Archbishop Cranmer, proved fatal to both of them, and to Derham as well. Culpeper's sentence was for some reason commuted to one of simple beheading. Derham, less fortunate, was hanged, drawn, and quartered. Both executions took place at Tyburn on the 10th of December. Henry had loved the vapid little Catherine in his fashion. Such had been his reaction when he received proof of her behaviour that the French ambassador thought that he had been driven insane. He had even called for a sword with which to kill her himself, and had spent Christmas wandering from palace to palace, from room to room, in abject misery, though how much this was due to bereavement, how much to jealousy, and how much to wounded pride is hard to assess. Catherine lived a little longer than her two lovers. It was not until Monday, the 13th of February, 1542, that she was taken by boat to the Tower, passing under the bridge where the heads were still to be seen, impaled on those all too familiar stakes, and there on the hill, that she was beheaded by a single stroke of the axe. Many people believe that her ghost still frequents the haunted gallery at Hampton Court, where her shrieks have occasionally been heard. Eustace Chapuys, who had been the Emperor's ambassador for the past 13 years, and knew him better than most, describes in a letter how the monstrous old king, already giving premature signs of senility, was struck helpless and blind with tears in the middle of a court ball, when the cannon from the Tower told him that his fifth wife had suffered the same fate as his second. Then, suddenly, after her death, and how typical it was of him, Henry's mood changed. He gave a great banquet with 26 ladies around him, and within a week of the beginning of Lent, he celebrated the carnival with still further feasting. It was even rumoured that he was ready to take Anne of Cleves, with whom he had exchanged sumptuous New Year presents, back to his bed. But no, for the moment he had had enough of Venus. It was time, once again, for Mars. 6. Noisome to our realm. When, on the 29th of August, 1526, the forces of Suleiman the Magnificent smashed the Hungarians at Mohács and shortly afterwards sacked their capital at Buda, rule over the defeated country was disputed by the Sultan's vassal, John Zápolya, and Charles V's brother Ferdinand. In 1538 the two had come to an agreement, according to which each might reign in peace over his own territory, but on the death of Zápolya, who was at the time a bachelor of 51, all Hungary should go to the Habsburgs. In the following year, however, a complication arose. Zápolya married Isabella, the daughter of King Sigismund of Poland, who shortly afterwards bore him a son, John Sigismund. This made the situation difficult enough, and when the proud father died 2 weeks later, it became trickier still. Ferdinand lost no time in claiming that the baby was not Isabella's at all, at the same time sending an embassy to Istanbul, insisting that the kingdom should be immediately made over to him. Now Suleiman obviously had no intention of agreeing to a further expansion of the already vast Habsburg domains, but he decided first of all to establish the identity of this problem child. An emissary was at once sent off to Isabella. On his arrival, we are told, "The queen took her infant in her arms and presented it to the Turkish ambassador as an orphan, with no support except the protection of the great lord. Then, with a completely maternal grace, she bared her breast of alabaster and nursed the baby in the presence of the Turk, who kneeled, kissed the feet of the newborn, and, putting his hand on the chest of the port's tiny protégé, swore that the son of King John, to the exclusion of all others, should rule over Hungary." The ambassador's oath, when it was reported to Ferdinand, was by no means what he wished to hear. He immediately laid siege to Buda, whereupon Isabella appealed to the Sultan for help. For Suleiman there was only one option. Ferdinand was on the march, Isabella was clearly powerless against the turbulent Hungarian nobility, John Sigismund was still a baby. He must quickly annex the entire country, and so he did. As a Turkish flotilla sailed up the Danube, the Austrian opposition seemed to melt away, and on the 2nd of September 1541, the Sultan, accompanied by his son Bayezid, made his formal entry into Buda. He did not, however, keep the whole of Hungary under direct Ottoman control. After long and difficult diplomatic negotiations, the country was split once again, this time into three separate parts. The central and southern provinces, including Buda itself, were retained by the Sultan and subjected to his direct rule. The northwestern region, Royal Hungary as it was known, was to remain under the Habsburgs. The eastern part was the subject of a diploma, written in characters of gold and azure, in which the Sultan promised, by the prophet, his sabre and his ancestors, to surrender it to John Sigismund as soon as he attained his majority. Just 3 weeks after Suleiman marched into Buda, Charles V set sail for Algiers. 6 years earlier, his capture of Tunis had been a triumph. This time he was heading for disaster. Algiers was by now the most powerful of all the Turkish corsair bases that lay along the Barbary coast. Charles, who had obviously enjoyed his previous North African adventure, was determined that the city should be destroyed. His admirals strongly advised him against any such attempt so late in the year, and he would have done well to follow their advice. It was late October by the time he landed, and the weather had broken. Several ships had been lost in a storm, some of them carrying sections of the Imperial archives. Torrential rain made organized disembarkation impossible. Furious winds tore the anchors from their moorings and smashed the ships against each other. A day or two later, the Emperor himself narrowly escaped capture. He had no choice but to beat an immediate and fairly ignominious retreat. Abandoning both his horses and his guns, he returned via the Balearic Islands to Spain. Fortunately for Charles, Barbarossa had not been in the neighbourhood at the time. Now about 60, but obviously feeling a good deal younger, he was deeply engaged in the planning of a further campaign, this time against southern Italy. In 1542, the Sultan, who was himself preparing to lead another of his immense expeditions into central Europe, and had no need of his fleet, had offered it to Francis for the following summer. This, consequently, would be a joint operation with France. Some 120 vessels left Istanbul in April and ravaged the coasts of Italy and Sicily, although, allegedly at the king's insistence, they carefully avoided the Papal States. At Gaeta, the old pirate, almost unbelievably, married the governor's 18-year-old daughter, a girl, we are told, of quite startling beauty. His passion for her was said to have hastened his death. After several weeks of successful looting, the fleet at last arrived at Marseille, where a tremendous welcome awaited it. Barbarossa, himself superbly dressed and encrusted with jewels, was received by the 23-year-old François de Bourbon, Count of Enghien, who presented him with a plethora of priceless gifts, including a silver sword of honour. In return, the Duke received, on behalf of the Sultan, a small stable of magnificent Arab horses, superbly accoutred. Here, if indeed one was needed, was an impressive illustration of the importance that France attached to her friendship with the Turks. But the celebrations ended badly. Barbarossa had expected to discuss plans for the forthcoming campaign against the Emperor, but he soon discovered that the French, for all their promises and solemn undertakings, had made virtually no serious preparations at all. Their ships were completely unprepared for war. They had not even been provisioned. Suddenly, protocol was forgotten. Barbarossa lost his temper. "He became scarlet with anger," wrote an eyewitness, "and tore at his beard, furious to have made such a long voyage with such a large fleet, and to be condemned in advance to an action." The news was reported to Francis, who did his best to pacify him, ordering the immediate provisioning of several of the Turkish vessels, as well as his own. But even then there was serious disagreement as to their joint plan of action. Barbarossa had hoped for a direct attack on the Emperor in Spain, but for Francis such an operation was clearly impossible. The reproaches of all Christendom would rain down upon his head. He proposed instead an attack on Nice, which was at that time ruled by the staunchly imperialist Duke of Savoy. This was not by any means the sort of campaign that Barbarossa had had in mind, but he was forced to accept, though with considerable reluctance, that in the circumstances it was the best that could be hoped for. If the siege of Nice in August 1543 is remembered at all in the city today, it is because of the courage of its local heroine. Early in the morning of the 15th, heavy bombardment by Barbarossa's galleys had opened a breach in the walls near one of the principal towers. The French and Turks poured through it, and a Turkish standard-bearer was about to plant his flag on the tower when a local washerwoman, her name was Catherine Segurin, and it has passed into history, seized it from his hands and, with a few brave men whom she had summoned to support her, led a furious counterattack. The invaders were beaten back, leaving 300 dead behind them. Nice was temporarily saved, but for all her heroism, Catherine had only delayed the inevitable. According to another version of the story, Catherine showed her heroism by standing in front of the invading forces and exposing her bare bottom, the sight of which is said to have so shocked the Muslim sensibilities of the Turkish infantry that they turned tail and fled. A memorial plaque with an illustration in bas-relief was erected in 1923 near the supposed location of her action. Perhaps unfortunately, it illustrates the first version of the story, not the second. Just a week later, on the 22nd, the governor of the city formally surrendered. In doing so, he was entitled, and doubtless expected, to be offered honourable terms, but within 2 days Nice was sacked and put to the torch. Inevitably, the Turks were blamed. In fact, it was almost certainly the French who were responsible. Such was the opinion of the Maréchal de Vieilleville, dictating his memoirs shortly before his death in 1571. The city of Nice was plundered and burned, for which neither Barbarossa nor the Saracens can be blamed, for when it occurred they were already far away. Responsibility for the outrage was thrown at poor Barbarossa to protect the honour and reputation of France, and indeed of Christianity itself. The siege and capture of Nice was the first and last joint operation of the Franco-Turkish alliance. The sight of Christians fighting Christians with the help of infidels left many deeply shocked, but that was only the beginning. Barbarossa now demanded that his entire fleet should be refitted and revictualled, and Francis was obliged to invite him to occupy Toulon for the winter. Many of the town's inhabitants, brought up on hideous tales of Turkish atrocities, left the town in terror. To the astonishment of those who remained, however, Barbarossa imposed an iron discipline and, in the words of a French diplomat, never did an army live more strictly or in better order. Presents, as always, were exchanged. The commander of the French galleys, Virgilio Orsini, was delighted to receive a beautiful box of ivory and ebony with pictures of the 11 Ottoman sultans painted around the rim. The only drawback was the expense. Francis was obliged to pay Barbarossa 30,000 ducats a month, and Provence and the whole surrounding area was heavily taxed in consequence. To make matters worse, the old ruffian did not seem in any hurry to leave, nor indeed did his men, for most of whom it was their first experience of the Côte d'Azur, and they were predictably enchanted by it. Finally, however, it was made clear to them that they were outstaying their welcome, and in April 1544 Barbarossa, having at the last moment completed his revictualling operations by ransacking 5 French ships in the harbour, returned to a hero's welcome in Istanbul, ravaging en route Elba, Procida, Ischia and Lipari with its fellow Ionian islands, all of which were imperial territory. 2 years later, he was dead. Just a month before the siege of Nice, at Hampton Court on the 12th of July 1543, King Henry married for the last time. Catherine Parr was his 6th wife. She herself had been twice widowed, so he was her 3rd husband. After his death, she was to marry a 4th. The daughter of a Northamptonshire squire, she was worth a dozen of her 4 immediate predecessors in the king's bed, though even she could not have held a candle to Catherine of Aragon. She was a moderate Protestant, intelligent and highly educated, and she took Henry firmly in hand. It was thanks to her, for example, that his 3 children were brought together for the first time in their lives, and that Mary and Elizabeth were both restored to the line of succession. At her urging, too, they both undertook translations of Erasmus. Elizabeth also translated The Mirror of Glass of the Sinful Soul by Marguerite of Navarre. Her own book, Prayers Stirring the Mind Unto Heavenly Meditations, was the first work ever published by an English queen under her own name, though these have admittedly been few. Thus it was that although Henry's declining years could only have been a martyrdom, in his last marriage at least he was perhaps almost as happy as in the early years of his first. Meanwhile, the somewhat desultory war between Charles and Francis dragged on. Henry had originally planned to intervene with a major invasion of France in 1543, but it had to be postponed owing to serious trouble with the Scots. There had been problems, too, with his new alliance with Charles. The Emperor was deeply embarrassed at the prospect of concluding any alliance with an excommunicated schismatic, and refused absolutely to sign any document according the king his full style, which included the title of Supreme Head of the Church. Nor, by the terms of Henry's excommunication, could he undertake to defend England against attack if the Pope were to decide to turn the war into a crusade. Henry pointed out that Charles had not always been so respectful of Rome. His destruction of the city and imprisonment of the Pope in 1527 were still fresh in the minds of all Romans. A crusade was in fact extremely unlikely, owing to Francis's friendship with Suleiman. Nonetheless, Europe was now faced with what would and should have seemed an unlikely situation indeed, that of an alliance between an emperor and a schismatic king against the most Christian king and the infidel Turk. Matters were eventually settled when Henry agreed to be described as Defender of the Faith rather than Supreme Head of the Church, but now a new embarrassment arose. He announced that he himself would be in command of both the forthcoming English invasion of France and its projected advance on Paris. This decision caused a degree of consternation, both in England and in the Empire. The king was now 53, in poor health, and suffering constant pain from his ulcerated leg. The rigours of the campaign might well prove too much for him. Moreover, the royal armourers would have a hard time accommodating his prodigious bulk, and by the time they had done so, it would be hard to find any horse mighty enough to carry him. Even if nothing worse befell, his presence could not fail to slow the entire army down. The difficulty was that no one except the emperor dared to tell him so, and the emperor's words fell on deaf ears. Fortunately, as the time for departure drew on, Henry himself began to lose his nerve. He now proposed that neither ruler should take the field in person, but that each should entrust his army to the best commanders available. This proposal, however, was at once rejected by the emperor. He was, he pointed out, nearly 10 years younger than Henry and, apart from his gout, in much better physical shape. Had he not travelled all the way from Spain to Germany with the express purpose of leading his army into France? How, then, possibly could he pull out at the last moment? To do so would involve serious loss of face, and might even invite accusations of cowardice. He was implacably resolved to march with his men. To Henry that settled the matter. If Charles was determined to march, he would march too. His armourers would simply have to use their ingenuity, and a suitable horse must somehow be found. But was he himself capable of riding all the way from the coast to Paris? Alas, almost certainly not. But then the emperor must not do so either. He sent a further message to Charles. Was it really wise at this early stage to make directly for the capital, leaving the army's flanks exposed to hostile action? Would it not be better first to concentrate on the towns along the coast and the frontier before plunging deep into the French heartland? Once again he was snubbed. The plans had already been agreed. Charles saw no point in changing them. The argument was still continuing when, early in June, the English army crossed the Channel to Calais under the joint command of the king and of those two hoary veterans, the Dukes of Suffolk and of Norfolk. It then moved eastward into French territory, but still without any orders informing it of its ultimate destination or of what it was to do when it got there. This indecision was to continue for well over a fortnight. The month was nearing its end when the Duke of Norfolk, sitting disconsolately in a field somewhere in France with a large, bewildered and increasingly hungry army, pointed out somewhat tersely to the Privy Council that most generals, before they were dispatched abroad, were given orders as to where they were meant to be going. Such incompetence would never have occurred, he rather ill-advisedly pointed out, in Wolsey's day or in Cromwell's. At last the king made up his mind. Norfolk was to lay siege to Montreuil, while he himself and Suffolk would concentrate on Boulogne. Charles protested indignantly once again that the plan had been to advance against Paris, to which Henry retorted, without a shred of justification, that without possession of the two towns under siege, there would be no means of adequately provisioning an advancing army. And that, so far as he was concerned, was that. He marched with Suffolk to Boulogne, and in early August settled down to the siege. Charles, meanwhile, continued his advance through Champagne until Paris itself was seriously threatened. Francis, back in the Louvre, declared his resolution to live and die there. It soon became clear that Norfolk's attempt on Montreuil was doomed to failure. His best efforts seemed to have no appreciable effect on the fortifications. The Boulogne operation, on the other hand, proved a remarkable success. Henry enjoyed himself enormously, trotting from station to station, giving and countermanding orders. All those around him remarked on how much better he was in health and spirits. On the 11th of September, to his great delight, his men managed to blow up the castle, and on the 18th he entered the town in triumph. Once the excitement was over, however, and he had begun to weigh up the achievements of the campaign in comparison with its immense cost, his ebullience deserted him. He had not taken Paris, or even attempted to. His alliance with the emperor was in shreds. Worse, he now learned that Charles had now abandoned his march on Paris, and that on the very day the English had taken Boulogne, he and Francis had made a peace at Crepy-en-Lannoy, agreeing inter alia to abandon their conflicting claims and later to wage a joint campaign against the Turks. This peace was disastrous news indeed. Henry, left in the lurch, now had the whole weight of the French army against him. Worse still, a considerable force led by the Dauphin was already on the march to relieve Montreuil. Not that Montreuil needed much relieving. It was, so far as the miserable Duke of Norfolk could see, totally impregnable, and well supplied with provisions of all kinds. His men, on the other hand, were frustrated and half-starved, and he was only too pleased to receive the king's orders to raise the siege and, avoiding the Dauphin's army as best he could, to withdraw to Boulogne. Not, however, for long. Leaving his army in the newly captured town, Henry returned to England at the end of the month. But he had not even reached London when still more disastrous news was brought to him. The Dukes of Norfolk and of Suffolk, in flagrant defiance of his own clearly expressed orders, had led almost the entire army out of Boulogne and had returned with it to Calais. Their excuse was that the king's plans for building new defences for Boulogne were impracticable, and that it was Calais that needed help and support against the advancing Dauphin. But Henry did not believe them for a moment. He knew perfectly well that with the approach of the French army, the two had simply lost their heads and fled back for safety on English soil. Furious, he ordered them to return to their posts, but this was no longer possible. The army was now near mutiny, and the Dauphin had Calais surrounded. There was nothing for it but to do their best to come to terms with the French, and in mid-October, talks began at Calais. They failed completely. Henry insisted that he must keep Boulogne, and also that Francis should abandon his alliance with Scotland, with which he had recently renewed all his country's former treaties. Neither of these demands was acceptable to the French, who early in November returned angrily to Paris. Henry had earned himself a little breathing space with the approach of winter, but he and Francis were still in a state of war, and now his relations with Charles were very little better. He had complained bitterly of the Emperor's defection, but Charles had indignantly replied that it was the English who had been guilty of betrayal. It was they, not he, who had refused to undertake the planned march on Paris, while their so-called siege of Montreuil had been pure pretense. They had merely sat outside the town doing nothing. The attack on Boulogne had been their sole intention from the very beginning. If Henry had not insisted so ridiculously on participating in the campaign himself, then he, the Emperor, would never have acted as he did. And anyway, had not Henry specifically agreed that Charles should be free to make peace unilaterally? No, replied Henry. Their agreement at Calais had been that each might negotiate independently, but that neither would conclude a treaty without further consultation between them. And it got worse. Henry now began accusing Charles of allowing Spanish troops to fight for the French, and of turning a blind eye when the Inquisition dared to mistreat innocent English merchants in Spain. Charles, who had been seriously delayed by the siege of Saint-Dizier, where the French garrison had held out heroically for 41 days, countered with complaints that the English had laid hands on imperial ships and cargoes, that 700 Spanish arquebusiers had been lured to the Scottish borders, where another war was in progress, and that Henry had been secretly negotiating with the German Lutherans. By midsummer 1545, relations between the two rulers were once again near breaking point, and meanwhile the French were closing in. French ships were blockading Boulogne, and a French invasion became once again a serious danger. Money also was a problem. The campaign of 1544 had cost nearly three times what had been expected. Already for the past 3 years, Henry had been subsisting largely on what he called benevolences, forced loans, or more accurately, false gifts, from donors who for the most part were very far from benevolent, and on the sales of formerly monastic lands. The currency, meanwhile, had been debased on a dramatic scale by reminting coins with increasing proportions of base metal, and Henry even conceived a project of borrowing church plate, a practice much approved of by the Earl of Hertford, whose influence with the king was by this time considerable. God's service, he assured his master, which consisteth not in jewels, plate, or ornaments of gold and silver, cannot thereby be anything diminished, and those things better employed for the weal and defence of the realm. Henry may well have been desperate for money, but, as he knew in his heart, it was all his own fault. His passion for campaigning, which for the last 5 years of his life was to cost him well over £2 million, had yielded him remarkably little. And now, thanks entirely to him, England was in greater danger than she had been even in 1539, and perhaps for generations. He had also quite unnecessarily antagonized his most important fellow rulers, from one of whom he now confidently expected an invasion. And he was right to do so. On the evening of Sunday, 19th of July, 1545, a French fleet of over 200 ships entered the Solent. Henry, who chanced to be dining that night on board the Henry Grâce à Dieu, better known as the Great Harry, hastened ashore while the English fleet moved against the invaders. It was on this occasion that the English flagship, the Mary Rose, suddenly keeled over and sank. The wreck was rediscovered in 1971 and is now on show in its own museum in Portsmouth. A recently prepared chain of beacons was lit to carry warnings across the country, and on the following day the French landed on the Isle of Wight. After only 24 hours, rather surprisingly, they re-embarked, only to land again at Seaford shortly afterwards. But this landing too proved temporary, and after a quick and inconclusive skirmish with the English fleet off Beachy Head, they set sail for home. It was all rather an anticlimax. The danger was, however, that these short raids might well have been simply exploratory, preparing the way for something a good deal more ambitious. Henry certainly feared as much, and on the 10th of August he ordered the church authorities to stage religious processions throughout the kingdom, together with public prayers for victory. It would have been more suitable, notes Professor Scarisbrick, if they had prayed for survival. In fact, there were to be no more invasions, but the situation remained desperate. Stephen Gardiner, now Bishop of Winchester, wrote, "We are at war with France and Scotland, we have enmity with the Bishop of Rome, we have no assured friendship here with the Emperor, and we have received from the Landgrave, chief captain of the Protestants, such displeasure that he has cause to think us angry with him. Our war is noisome to our realm, and to all our merchants that traffic through the narrow seas. We are in a world where reason and learning prevail not, and covenants are little regarded." He spoke no more than the truth. By the end of 1545, England was as near bankruptcy as she had ever been. But the Emperor Charles had his worries too, and among his principal ones was the Sultan Suleiman, whose operations in Hungary were becoming an increasingly dangerous threat to his empire. Early in 1544, at the Diet of Speyer, in return for the promise of generous financial support, Charles had undertaken to lead a campaign in person against the Turks, but had been prevented from doing so by the subsequent fighting in France. His brother Ferdinand had accordingly attempted to negotiate a truce to buy a little more time. This, however, had been bitterly resented by his Hungarian subjects, who had accused him of going back on his word and of agreeing to a shoddy peace when he had promised to make war. By this time, Charles had become convinced that Francis, despite the promises that he had made at Crepy, had no intention of marching against Suleiman, with whom his surprisingly friendly relations were well known across Europe. He and Ferdinand accordingly entrusted Francis with the task of renegotiating a truce, one that the Hungarians would be readier to accept. Both they and the French sent special envoys to Istanbul. The empire was to be represented by a certain Gerhard Weltwig, a converted Jew and an eminent Hebrew scholar. France by an experienced diplomat, Jean de Montluc. The trouble was that Charles and Francis had not given their respective ambassadors similar briefs. Thus, from the very beginning, confusion reigned. Montluc had instructions to explain to the Sultan that the Emperor was coming as a supplicant, on Francis's insistence. Weltwig, on the other hand, had been briefed to claim that the Emperor had been assured by Francis that the Turks longed for peace and had guaranteed the success of the mission. If, in other words, the negotiations were to fail, it would be the fault of the French. All this was unfortunate enough, but there was worse to come. Weltwig now discovered that yet another ambassador, a Dr. Secco, was already in Istanbul, having been dispatched by Archduke Ferdinand. He wrote at once to Secco, instructing him to suspend all negotiations until his arrival, but his letter was intercepted by the Turks, who concluded, correctly, that Charles and his brother must be at cross purposes. Almost incredibly, there was another French representative there too, one Gabriel d'Aramont, who deeply resented the arrival of Montluc and managed to prevent any further instructions being sent to him. All this could have ended in disaster. Suleiman had still not forgiven Francis for what he considered was a betrayal at Crepy, after which he had very nearly impaled the luckless French ambassador. But he was fully occupied with his preparations for a new campaign in Persia, and had no wish to fight on two fronts simultaneously. He was happy to agree to a limited pause in hostilities, its precise duration to be settled later. Weltwig and Montluc then returned to their respective courts, with d'Aramont returning separately. The following summer, 1545, Weltwig and d'Aramont were back in Istanbul, Montluc having presumably had enough of his fellow ambassador's intrigues. D'Aramont arrived this time with a magnificent entourage and sumptuous presents for the Sultan, including a vast clock made in Lyon with a fountain, which worked for 12 hours once the water had been poured in. One member of Darmon's following, Pierre Bellon, left a full account of his travels, noting, inter alia, that the Turks had no understanding of the pleasures of the table. They served nothing but cucumbers and raw greens without oil or vinegar. The main course tended to be porridge. Ne font jamais délices, he moans. His purpose was to persuade Suleiman to launch an immediate attack on the emperor in Hungary, but the sultan remained firm. He gratefully accepted the clock, but refused any suggestion of an attack. On the 13th of June, he agreed with Veltbik on a 5-year truce, by the terms of which Charles and Ferdinand gave their full recognition to Ottoman Hungary and undertook to pay an annual tribute of 30,000 gold florins in respect of their Habsburg possessions in the north and west of the country. He, in return, gave his assurance that peace would be maintained along his borders. He then wrote Francis a cordial letter of explanation, in which he promised to maintain the friendship and fidelity that the two had enjoyed in the past. The agreement was eventually signed at Adrianople, the modern Edirne, in November 1545, and was replaced by a full peace treaty 2 years later. Charles was at last free to turn to his problems in Germany. He was, however, bitterly criticized throughout Europe. For all good, God-fearing Catholics, the Sultan was Antichrist, the beast of the apocalypse. To treat him as an equal, arguably even as a superior, was a sin not to be forgiven. It had been bad enough when Francis, the most Christian king, had allied himself with the infidel, but for the emperor himself to do so, and to undertake furthermore to make an annual payment of a very considerable sum in return for the relatively small part of Hungary under Habsburg control, a payment that implied recognition of Turkish sovereignty over the whole country, and which the Turks unhesitatingly described as a tribute, that was far, far worse. What was it indeed but a betrayal? A betrayal not only of Christendom, but of Jesus Christ himself. Patriotic Hungarians now spat at the very mention of the emperor's name. They had looked to him to help them regain their ancient kingdom, but this last action had proved that he was no longer to be trusted, that he had feet of clay. As for the German Protestants, their hatred for the Sultan was every bit as heartfelt. But, whether they confessed it or not, they owed him a considerable debt. As the Bishop of Montpellier pointed out to Francis, had it not been for the Turks, the Reformation might easily have suffered the same fate as had the Albigensians. The Albigensians, or Cathars, were a medieval Christian sect based in southwest France, which was brutally stamped out by a crusade under Louis VIII and by the Inquisition. The fact was that Charles needed the German Protestants to help him to resist Ottoman pressure on Central Europe. Thus he had had no choice but in 1532 to sign the Peace of Nuremberg, which was finally to lead to the Peace of Augsburg in 1555, officially recognizing the existence of Protestantism in Germany. The Turks were fully aware of all this. They had always favored the Protestants more than the Catholics because of their disapproval of the worship of idols, and they were probably every bit as quietly grateful to the Protestants as the Protestants were to them. But if Charles was at least in part reconciled to the Protestants, the Pope was not. Reared in the court of Lorenzo the Magnificent, Alessandro Farnese was a child of the Renaissance. Although a cardinal at 25, he had since cheerfully fathered 4 children. As Pope Paul III, he was equally shameless in his nepotism, raising 2 of his grandsons to the sacred college at the ages of 16 and 14 respectively. He revived the carnival in 1536. Rome resounded to the cheers of bullfights, horse races and firework displays, the Vatican to the music of balls and banquets, and yet, and this is what makes him one of the most interesting popes of the 16th century, he turned out to be a man of strong moral conscience and one of the most effective reformers of the Roman Catholic Church. The more Pope Paul considered how best to contain the surge, the more convinced he became that the prime necessity was for a general council, and one, he accepted, that would have to include a strong contingent of Lutherans. Objections, inevitably, were raised on all sides. The cardinals saw any reform as a threat to their own comfortable lifestyles. The emperor, terrified that the proposed council might take so rigid a stand on doctrine as to make a compromise with his Protestant subjects impossible, preferred that it should leave aside all theological questions and confine itself to measures of reform. The Lutherans demanded a totally uncommitted meeting of all Christians and steadfastly refused to attend any assembly held on Italian soil or one presided over by the Pope. Charles himself, who never felt particularly strongly about doctrine, would happily have accepted any compromise proposed or agreed to by Rome. All he wanted was unity. As for the King of France, he was only too pleased to see the Emperor enmeshed in his religious problems, and had no wish at all to have them resolved. But Pope Paul persisted, and meanwhile summoned a special commission. This was instructed to report on all the ills of the Church, and to recommend measures that should be taken to remedy them. In due course, the commissioners submitted their report. They did not pull their punches. They listed the current abuses and laid the blame for all of them, the sale of indulgences and church benefices, the sinecures, the stockpiling of bishoprics and countless others, squarely on the papacy. The result of all this, they pointed out, had been the Protestant Reformation, and no wonder. Had the church kept its house in order, the Reformation would never have occurred. The horrified curia, which had been deliberately banned from the commission, did all it could to sweep the report under the carpet. But a copy was leaked, and before long, a German translation was going the rounds of the jubilant Lutheran churches. Now at last reform, serious reform, was in the air, and Pope Paul did everything he could to encourage it. He gave an enthusiastic reception to the young Filippo Neri, whose mission was concentrated on the seedy inns and whorehouses of the Roman underworld, and a year or two later he accorded a similar welcome to the rather older Ignatius Loyola, a Basque who had arrived with half a dozen like-minded colleagues from Spain, grouped together in what they called the Society of Jesus. In 1540, the Pope issued a bull giving the Society his official approval. The Jesuits, with no distinctive dress for their order, no fixed headquarters and no choral prayer, were bound together by two things only: strict discipline and unconditional obedience. They were to have a checkered history, but they were the spearhead of the Counter-Reformation. Finally, on the 13th of December, 1545, the long-delayed council opened at Trent, a city recommended by the Emperor because it lay safely in imperial territory. It got off to a shaky start, its first sessions being attended by only a single cardinal, four archbishops, and 31 bishops. But it was gradually to gain momentum, and to continue at intervals, in Trent and later in Bologna, for the next 18 years. It was overwhelmingly weighted in favour of the Italians. Even when best attended, with more than 270 bishops, the Germans never numbered more than 13. But the important thing about the council was that, in the teeth of all opposition to it, it actually happened. Moreover, it showed itself ready to defy the Emperor and fearlessly to debate the hoary old questions of doctrine, justification by faith, transubstantiation, purgatory, and many more. It was never more than a partial success. When it was at last dissolved, the Protestants, who understandably saw it as little more than a Roman puppet show, naturally remained unsatisfied. Even for the Catholics, its reforms were less radical and comprehensive than many had hoped for. Not a word was said, for example, about the reform of the papacy itself, which was far more necessary than anything else. Owing largely to the undiminished hostility of the Emperor and the King of France, the council sat only intermittently, often without the French contingent. It never came near to being the ecumenical council of union for the whole of Western Christendom that had been so long hoped and prayed for. It was simply the confessional council of the Counter-Reformation, formed for the purpose of re-Catholicizing the continent, if necessary by force. The results were to be all too evident. In France, no fewer than 8 civil wars against the Huguenots, more than 3,000 of whom perished in the massacre of St. Bartholomew in Paris during the late summer of 1572, a war between Spain and the Netherlands that lasted for more than 80 years, and the nightmare 30 Years' War, 1618 to 48, which was to cause untold devastation through northern Europe. But the Council of Trent nevertheless established a solid basis for the renewal of discipline and spiritual life in the Church, which emerged a good deal stronger and more focused than before. It led to the codification of the Tridentine Creed and the Tridentine Mass, from Tridentum, the Latin name for Trent, which remained in use for the next 4 centuries, and it finally succeeded in stemming the Protestant tide. And for all that, the lion's share of the credit must go to that epicure, nepotist, and adulterer, Pope Paul III. By the end of 1545, King Henry's health was deteriorating fast. He was more enormous than ever, and with his festering legs was almost completely immobile. He could be moved about only on trolleys with huge winches to take him up and down stairs. On the other hand, he remained as determined as ever to continue the endless diplomatic struggle with his fellow monarchs. No longer did he have a Wolsey or a Cromwell to take decisions for him. No matter, he was quite prepared to take his own. Nor, come to that, did he have a pope to argue with. But the situation was quite complicated enough without the papacy. At least he knew what he wanted, and what he now wanted above all was to retain his hold on Boulogne. Again and again his council pressed him to give it up. Until he did so, they pointed out, there could be no peace with France, and the country simply could not afford to continue the war. But Henry would hear none of it. The conquest of the town had cost him dear. It had become a symbol, and he intended to hang on to it, come what might. Unfortunately, he was unlikely to succeed in doing so without the help of the Emperor, whom he was now vehemently urging to renounce the peace he had so inexcusably agreed at Crepy and return to the Anglo-Imperial alliance he had made the year before. Charles, however, was not really interested. He was prepared to accept Henry's suggestion for a meeting, on condition that the king first reached an agreement with Francis. But any such agreement, he knew, would have to hinge on the surrender of Boulogne, which Henry refused to contemplate. The fact was that the emperor was bored with both the squabbling monarchs and would happily have wished a plague on both their houses. His overriding purpose now was to root out Protestantism from Germany. For the moment, so far as he was concerned, nothing else mattered. The German Protestants knew, for their part, that if they hoped to survive at all, they would need all the help they could get. In September 1545, Hesse, Saxony, and Württemberg actually sent a joint delegation to England, not to ask directly for aid, but with an offer to mediate between Henry and Francis, in order that the two kings, once again on friendly terms, might then join them in an alliance to resist imperial attack. Henry agreed to their proposal, but their attempts failed. They had not begun to understand the complexity of the problems involved, and the French were not in a giving mood. The war, therefore, continued. There had been intermittent skirmishing around Boulogne and Calais for some months past, culminating in an unfortunate incident when a smallish force under the Duke of Norfolk's son, the swashbuckling young Earl of Surrey — Surrey was a far better poet than he was a soldier. He and his friend Sir Thomas Wyatt were the first English poets to write in the sonnet form that Shakespeare was to make famous, and he was the first to publish blank verse, unrhymed iambic pentameters, in his translation of books 2 and 4 of the Aeneid. He is buried in a spectacular tomb of painted alabaster in the church of St. Michael the Archangel at Framlingham in Suffolk. Had been badly mauled near the fortress of St. Etienne, and in January 1546 Henry decided to assert his position. He sent Edward Seymour, Earl of Hertford, to France with some 25,000 men and 4,000 horses, supported by a fleet of 45 sail. Hertford and his army duly landed at Calais in March, but they did not get very far, not because of French resistance, but because the king suddenly changed his mind. Why he did so, we do not know. Perhaps his agents had failed to find enough food, arms, or munitions. Perhaps it was Charles's refusal to help him. Perhaps there was simply not enough money. At any rate, he decided to make peace. Talks began towards the end of April. Both the English and the French were hard bargainers, and they were still arguing at the beginning of June. But on the 6th, the details were finally agreed, and on the 7th, in a tent between Ardres and Guisnes, virtually on the site of the Field of the Cloth of Gold, the peace treaty was signed. Boulogne would be returned to France in 1554 on payment of 2 million crowns. A week later, the imperial ambassador remarked to Henry that at such a price the town would remain English forever. The king, we are told, smiled knowingly. Good relations were, however, restored. At much the same time, Henry stood godfather, by proxy, to Francis's grandson. And when, at Fontainebleau, on the 1st of August, 1546, Francis ratified the treaty, the most Christian king had no hesitation in designating Henry, as he wished to be designated, as supreme head of the Church of England and Ireland. But by this time it was clear to all around him that King Henry had little time left. Despite his by now prodigious girth, that superb constitution with which he had been born had until recently preserved him remarkably well. He had survived an early attack of smallpox in 1514, and had never shown the faintest sign of the consumption that had accounted for his father, his elder brother, and his bastard son, and which was soon to carry off his legitimate son, King Edward VI. Unfortunately, he was not proof against accidents, particularly in the tilt yard. There had been a particularly serious one at Greenwich in 1536, when his armoured horse had fallen on top of him, and he had lain unconscious for 2 hours. At that time he was already 44 years old, and dangerously overweight. To those who knew him well, he was never quite the same again. And then there was the ulcer on his thigh. It had already plagued him for years, certainly since 1528. Inevitably, it had led to suspicions of syphilis, but these were almost certainly groundless. More likely is that it was the result of varicose veins, or even perhaps osteomyelitis. Whatever the cause, it had spread to the other leg. Both were by now badly ulcerated, giving him constant pain. And yet, as late as 1544, we find him not only still in the saddle, but fighting in France. The final decline seems to have begun in the autumn of 1546. It was then, too, that the king began behaving strangely, notably by turning with unprecedented savagery on the Duke of Norfolk and the Earl of Surrey, his son. Surrey had admittedly failed to distinguish himself while on campaign in the previous year, but he was certainly not plotting to seize the throne, as Henry seemed to think. Nevertheless, he was beheaded, at the age of 29 or 30, on the 19th of January, 1547, on a charge of treason. The Duke himself, despite his almost universal unpopularity, had served his country well, but he too was charged, and subsequently condemned to suffer the same fate as his son. Fortunately, he was to be saved by the king's death. The council had no wish to inaugurate the new reign of Edward VI with bloodshed. He remained, however, in the Tower throughout Edward's reign, to be finally released and pardoned by Queen Mary in 1553. On the 26th of December, 1546, Henry sent for his will, with which he pronounced himself deeply unsatisfied. The last month of his life was taken up with endless arguments and changes of mind, all of which probably stimulated him and kept him alive a little longer. Among a number of other provisions, he confirmed the legitimacy of his daughters, Mary and Elizabeth, and restored them both to the line of succession. But the end was near, and he knew it. He died in the early hours of Friday, the 28th January, 1547, aged 55, having reigned for the best part of 38 years. On the 14th of February, his embalmed body was carried to Windsor in a procession 4 miles long and buried in St. George's Chapel, next to the coffin of Jane Seymour, as he had directed. And that should have been the end of the story of King Henry VIII. Alas, it was not. All through the 5-year reign of his sad and sickly son, the work continued on his magnificent tomb, but on the succession of Queen Mary it suddenly stopped. As much of the tomb as had already been built was demolished by Parliament in 1646 during the Civil War. The empty sarcophagus and its base were eventually used in 1806 for the tomb of Lord Nelson in St. Paul's. A certain Sir Francis Englefield, one of Mary's privy councillors, later revealed that he had been present at Windsor when Henry's grave had been opened and what was left of his body pulled out and ceremonially consigned to the flames. He may have been the Queen's father, but he was an unrepentant heretic and schismatic. In the eyes of his daughter, no other fate was possible. But when the smoke had cleared away, one fact remained undisputed. Of all the kings since the Norman conquest, King Henry VIII had been by no means the best, but none had been more radiant of kingship, nor had any done more to change the face of England. Henry had defied both emperor and pope. He had shaken off the grip of Rome, although, and this should be emphasized, he had not embraced Protestantism, which was to come only in the reign of his son Edward. To the day of his death he would certainly not have changed a word of his book against Luther, for which Leo X had granted him the title of Defender of the Faith, except to make it clear that it was no longer to the pope, but to the king that Englishmen owed obedience. All the other essentials of Catholic worship, including the liturgy, remained unaltered. With the help of Thomas Cromwell, he had given the country a superb administrative organization, far more efficient than it had ever possessed before. He had transformed the English navy, building for the first time ships that fired broadsides, and thus revolutionizing naval warfare. He had brought to his subjects the splendor of the English Bible, and he had broken the power of the monasteries, raising, it should be noted, no issues of doctrine. On the debit side, he had been responsible for the destruction of literally hundreds of glorious buildings and thousands of the priceless treasures they contained. As a child of the Renaissance and a professed lover of the arts, did he ever regret what he had done? He showed no sign of doing so. nor despite countless undertakings.